a surprising state revenue forecast, Marlon Stutzman vying for his old job, plus a weakened physician non-compete bill, and more. From the television studios at WFYI, it's Indiana Week in Review for the week ending April 21st, 2023.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.
This week, Indiana lawmakers will have about $1.5 billion more dollars to work with in the new state budget than previously expected. That's as a surprising new state revenue forecast was unveiled. Predictions heading into Wednesday were that the new revenue forecast would be roughly in line with what lawmakers heard back in December when they began crafting a new budget. Instead, they'll have more than $1 billion more dollars to spend as a rosier economic outlook drives up expectations for tax revenue over the next 2 years. Senate budget architect Ryan Mishler says Indiana is in a strong place.
It always makes our job harder when there's more money because the more people asking. But you know, we're just fortunate to be in that position.
Mishler and House budget architect Jeff Thompson point out that the two chambers still have to work out some key budget differences: education and school voucher spending, whether to accelerate tax cuts, and how to provide property tax relief.
Well, it gives more flexibility, but we'll find a spot to land.
The session must end no later than April 29th. What does the revenue forecast do for final budget negotiations? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, editor-in-chief of the Indiana Capital Chronicle. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House Bureau Chief Brandon Smith. Mike O'Brien, does this make those negotiations easier?
No, it makes them infinitely more difficult because it's just like being at home, right? It's, if you have no money, the decisions on what to buy are easy. Nothing.
Right? Well, only the necessities.
Yeah, but we're not talking about no money and some money. We're talking about a lot of money and even more money.
Right. But so what that, being, you know, working in the State House, what that does to the expectations of the people who do have an interest in the budget, maybe weren't made whole in the House Republican budget or the Senate Republican budget, now we're back at the table, right? I mean, so it does make it more... It makes it easier because you're spending money in some ways. It makes it harder in other ways because now, you know, whatever priorities or whatever people's requests were that didn't get funded or didn't get fully funded, you know, they're back on the, you know, back on the drawing board.
Yeah, I mean, Brian Mosher said it. It's, yes, it makes our jobs harder, but it's a nice problem to have, kind of thing. One of the biggest sticking points is obviously going to be over voucher spending. The House Republicans want to expand it dramatically. Senate Republican budgets didn't include any expansion, but acknowledged that's not where we'll end up. With $1.5 billion more over the next budget, is significant voucher expansion now
for what,
a likelihood?
9% of the students as opposed to 91% of the students?
Who are also getting a big bump.
Yeah.
They will also
get a
bump.
They're not getting as much as they ought to get. The irony of this is how little credit Joe Biden gets for the fact that the national economy is doing so well. That recession that we've been waiting for now for 2 years doesn't any longer appear to be on the
horizon.
Well,
inflation helps government.
Well, that's right, but inflation has gone down the last couple of months, too. So, you know, I think it makes it more likely that we're actually going to see meaningful funding for mental health and health, and I also think we're going to have property tax relief. The Senate didn't do anything on that either. Cutting the income tax doesn't do anything. I mean, you cut it a half or a tenth of a percent, it's, what, 50 bucks over the year for most people? Property taxes are a problem, and what they need to do is put more state money into schools so you take the pressure off the local property taxes to get raised again or have referenda. And then you have enough money to do roads and police. So I think Representative Thompson's approach is exactly the right thing they ought to do, and they better deal with property tax increases.
Yeah, I think Senate President Pro Tem Roderick Bray said there will be 4 or 5 significant property tax provisions in the bill that's floating around out there by the end of session. 2 years ago, we got a revenue forecast in April that was $2 billion more dollars. Everybody freaked out. It was like, holy cow.
It's never going to happen again.
Yeah, never going to happen again. And a week ago, legislative leaders were all saying, we don't know what the budget, you know, the forecast is going to look like, but it'll probably be roughly what it was in December. 2 years ago, there was all that federal stimulus money, and so it kind of made sense why there was so much more money. Is this more shocking, even though it's slightly less money?
Yeah, I think it was definitely more shocking. I mean, I was going with what the leaders were saying, that, you know, maybe it'd be a small bump, but nothing big. I personally would like this problem to have. If I ever had to do a state budget, I would take this problem. But let's see. I mean, I think they've been clear that the mental health funding will definitely go up. Public health funding seems pretty solid. They're not really looking to do anything more than that. I don't think there's any way Senate Republicans can not give something to vouchers. I will point out that K-12 spending, while an increase, did not keep up with inflation.
Exactly.
So hopefully they can maybe do another couple percentages.
And Senate Republicans might even get their full $1 billion to pay off a teacher pension fund.
And let's not forget, the Senate proposal already had the billion and was keeping $3.2 billion in reserve.
Yeah.
Right.
So this is $1.5 billion on top of that.
We're going to spend more of the money than I'm planning on spending, and we might be getting close
to another automatic taxpayer refund.
Well, remember also the $500 million in Medicaid that'll come back to us, too.
Yeah,
so that's really $2 billion additional
dollars.
This
probably killed the cigarette tax, though, right?
Yeah.
You'd have to think the way they pay for health funding, both mental and public, is going to now just be general fund dollars. But to that point, the one thing that we seems like will not be going up in the final version of the budget is where the public health funding is right now, which both chambers were pretty much at $225 million over the biennium, which is less than the governor's, less than the governor's public health commission first recommendation, and way less than the revised recommendation. Are you surprised that that number is not going to go up?
Yeah, I guess I am a little bit, because the numbers, the need was so dire. We've talked about this many times on the show. When you look at the inequity right now that health departments from county to county, it's $88, I think, roughly per capita in Marion County, 88 cents in some county, maybe along the Ohio River. Yeah. So it's and there's a dire need. I mean, look at Hoosiers.
Every health metric.
And I point to my, we're not the healthiest group of people. So that could stand an increase. But what this whole thing does, and I should say I'm not as surprised, I guess, as all of you, because if you looked at the month in January, February, March, I mean, it was another unexpected, bonanza, 11%. I think February was 11% above projection. So this is not totally unexpected, I guess, maybe to this extent. But what this does, it seems to me, is kicks down, postpones until another day, let's put it that way, some of the sharp ideological debates that we're going to have to be determined. And I'm not talking Republic or R versus D. I'm talking R versus R.
Yeah.
And because if you didn't have this windfall, you would have had that clash, that Donnybrook over school choice. And by the way, the argument that it's 91% versus 9, I think that's flawed in that if advocates get their way, those numbers shift dramatically. It would be 50-50, or the advocates would say, I think if you put truth serum in their veins, we want 100% private.
91% of the students in this, the million students are in public
education. But my point is they want to see that change, and that's why the dollars are going.
Well, they don't like public education. Well, I'll concede that. They don't like teachers either.
But the same thing with, to your point where we started, back to the notion of public health, which again, that's not just money. That had to do with ideology and the role of the state versus local.
And that seems to be driving why the numbers.
Yeah, and this whole sort of anti-science sentiment. So a lot of that, though, will be masked or mitigated by the fact that we can delay those arguments for another day.
Time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question, and this week's question is, should spending $1 billion to pay down debt in a teacher pension fund be part of the new state budget? A yes or B no. Last week, we asked you whether a parent should be notified by a school when their child asks to change their name or pronouns. 49% of you say yes, 51% say no, and we definitely saw more answers than usual in that poll. If you'd like to take part, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, former 3rd District Republican Congressman Marlon Stutzman is running for his old job. Stutzman first expressed his desire to run weeks ago in a meeting with Allen County Republican Chairman Steve Schein, and he officially announced his bid this week.
The seat will be open in 2024 as current Congressman Jim Banks runs for the U.S. Senate. Stutzman served as 3rd District Representative from 2010 to 2017, leaving the seat after losing in the U.S. Senate primary to Todd Young. He joins a pool of candidates in the Republican primary that already includes former Allen County Circuit Judge Wendy Davis, State Senator Andy Zay, Attorney Chandler Likes, retired Army National Guard veteran Mike Filker, and retired Army veteran John Kenworthy.
Anne Delaney, does Marlon Stutzman immediately become the front runner in a crowded primary?
Look, Marvin Stutzman's been Marlon, out. Marlon, excuse me.
I've forgotten his name already.
He's been out of the picture for now 13 years. Okay.
Oh, no, he was 2016. He was
no,
still a congressman.
2010 he tried to run.
He came in 2010 and left in 2016 when he ran for the Senate against Todd Young.
Oh, okay. I
you
thought he ran against
somebody else.
I thought he ran. No, I thought he ran for Evans' open seat. No?
No.
He did in 10.
Yeah, he did in 10.
Then he tried again.
Let's get the point.
All right. Whatever. Whatever. My normal routine on this is...
It's been more than half a decade.
Yes. My normal routine on this is if you've got five suits and one skirt in a primary like that, the skirt wins. And I think, I don't know anything about that circuit court judge there, but I would think that she'd have a leg up, so to speak, on all of those guys.
I think she is considered by many to be one of the front runners. But how much does Stutzman entering this race change the math there?
It always matters. I mean, he's got name ID. He's got built-in work. His wife Christy was a state representative and also ran for Congress at one point not too long ago. So I mean, they're higher profile in the community, and so that matters. But so is a sitting judge, and so are these business people
state
and
senator,
the other people, state senator Randy Zay. And others. So, in a five-way primary, I think, and, put your finger on the scale, a little bit, if you're the woman, because you can differentiate yourself from
Susan,
the others.
Susan Brooks can tell you
and
that.
And they've got a great legislative delegation up there that's really
Victoria
engaged
Sparks
and plugged in, and they're pretty high. A lot of them are pretty high on Wendy Davis.
I do want to ask this, which is, we just went through a round of redistricting. The 5th district changed a fair amount. The 1st district changed a little bit as we saw how competitive that was. The 3rd didn't really change that much. How much does that help Marlon Stutzman? That it's roughly the same district he previously
served. Well, the theory would hold that to the extent that people have a memory and that there's little turnover in certain parts of the state, I mean, and that's not a lot of coming and going there other than just human attrition, living and dying, there will be people
human
who reap
attrition.
Human attrition. That's a technical term for death. I didn't want to get the unpleasant aspects of this in here. But I'm still thinking of Ann's comments. There's so much in a less politically correct time I would have said about her assessment of the race, but I'm not going to do any of it. But I think to that extent, there are a lot of people with decent name ID. So you got to look for what lever can really push you across the line. Gender certainly could be a distinguishing factor, but being somebody who presumably collected some political IOUs from that district.
Or irritated some people with
that. Well, that tends to happen too.
Well,
but
to that end, obviously there are, the name recognition helps so much, especially if the field gets even more crowded. It's just going to be, I recognize that name, okay. Does it hurt the fact that he's been gone for so long and now is running again? Like, it's like, well, you
I
just...
Think I don't like what I'm doing.
You
I'll
left,
back,
you left you this know? Once to try something else. It didn't work, and now you want to come back.
Well,
does that hurt generally more?
What might work against him is, sort of the office hopping thing. Like, you wanted to be a congressman, then you didn't want to be a congressman. You want to be a senator, and that didn't work out. So then now you want to be a congressman again. And with his wife also running, but then leaving, it sort of put some people off in Northeast Indiana. But I think one of the bigger issues is that, the Allen County contingent, is numerically bigger than some of the outskirts of that district where Marlon is more well known. And so I think it'll be hard to beat an Allen County person in the district. So we'll see.
So Wendy Davis.
Yep.
Seems like at this point the one to beat, but we'll see. Legislation that cleared the House this week will restrict non-compete agreements on some physicians, but Indiana Public Broadcasting's Adam Yehia Reyes reports the final version is weaker than what the state Senate originally passed, which fully banned such agreements.
The House version still partly bans new non-compete agreements, but only on primary care doctors. Other physicians can still be subject to a non-compete, prohibiting them working in a certain area for a time after leaving an employer. Representative Ryan Hatfield argues that goes too far.
This legislation specifically picks winners and losers and interferes in employment relationships in the private sector. Removing the prohibition on primary care non-competes will put all physicians on the same level.
Representative Ethan Manning says the bill should go further, like the original full ban.
I support putting all physicians on the same level playing field in that direction. I would have supported that bill, but our committee, after a couple of attempts, we came to what was a good compromise.
The House also added restrictions to nullify the agreements for other specialties in some cases, like if a doctor is terminated without cause.
Nikki Kelly, this is one of several bills this session whose purported aim is to help lower healthcare costs. The idea being here is we have a physician shortage, and this only makes it worse. But with the way that this has been changed, will it have enough impact?
Yeah, I don't know. I would say of all the bills that are moving out there on this healthcare cost thing, this is the one I see the least direct link to the cost. I certainly think you can make the argument about, you know, continuity of care. You know, people are getting, they have to move out of town for a year. There were people who testified, like, I'm traveling down to see my same doctor until he can move back, yeah, you know, to the city. So continuity of care and physician shortage stuff, I think, is absolute. But I'm not exactly sure how it impacts costs, yeah, per se.
I don't cover this bill. One of my colleagues has been all over this, and other colleagues have covered it in the past who've been on the healthcare beat. So I'm viewing this one really more as like a just somebody watching on the sidelines. I don't get how in a field where we are desperately trying to find as many doctors as we can, how we wouldn't ban these things outright. Why is that such a hard selling point for so many lawmakers?
You know, and this is a political, but this is not partisan necessarily, nope, in the classic sense, because it has to do with what your constituents, what hospitals are in your district or more likely aren't in your district and have closed. So, I mean, it's a fascinating, to your point, it's a fascinating bill to look at and try to peel back the various layers, because it's not what you would expect there to be. You know, you've got this, it's the nexus of concerns about the intrusion of government and employment, the employee-employer relationship. It's the notion of, picking winners and all the favorite cliches on both sides of the aisle that you hear are all kind of come to play here. And you can make arguments on both sides. If you take a step back, though, I would have said at the beginning of this session, there seemed to be such a drumbeat about the profits, let's call them the profits at nonprofit hospital, yeah, groups, some of them, the bigger ones, were making. I mean, that there had been the shot across the bow that the Senate President Pro Tem and the Speaker had issued to some of the larger hospital groups.
Raising the idea of we should be taxing them.
Well, not just and there were penalties essentially, yeah, built in that if you charge.
Those are still moving.
They're still,
yeah,
there. Right, still right. But I mean, if you look at a lot of these things, they have been scaled, yeah, back, and there's a lot more wiggle room than there used to be.
Now, the argument for employers here is we have invested money and time into these physicians. I suppose that might be even more true for the specialty physicians, which maybe begins to get at why they're largely carved out of the bill for the full bans. So I get that. But in a state, like many in the country, where we just need as many doctors as possible and we're having trouble finding them, can you afford not to go all the way?
I think you should go all the way. I've worked at two, I'm not a lawyer, but I've been a professional at two law firms. One had non-competes and one didn't. And the one that didn't, the managing partner's theory was, if the only thing keeping you here is that piece of paper, I'm probably not getting what I need out of you. So there's that piece of it too. And from a healthcare cost standpoint, I don't quite understand how it would lower healthcare costs. It may increase them because you get the chance now to go like maybe hire away a doc, but it's true in every profession that employers invest in employees, train employees. I've worked in multiple places where with great people where I learned a lot all that experience I took so I could be self-employed.
So you're right? One of the problems.
So yeah. But that's always true across all professions.
Yeah, the notion should be that the patient gets to pick the doctor and stay with the doctor the patient wants, just like you do with your lawyer in nine. Sure. I don't know how many law firms have non-competes. I think that's the exception rather than the rule, because you've got to be able to go with the person that you want, and anything else is an intrusion. And all this shows is that the hospital lobbies are stronger than the doctors' lobbies, is what it shows.
Well, we'll see where that comes out to at the end of session.
At least on the primary care doctors, what you're trying to do is to make certain that some of the rural communities, right, will have what, yeah, they need. They're not going, right, to have a heart specialist in, you know, a town of 500 people, but they are going to have a primary care doctor.
We hope they have a primary care.
We hope they have it, but the government ought to stay. They ought to just simply say, let the market work, and it doesn't work this way.
All right.
Supporters of a bill nearing the governor's desk say it will free Indiana schools from onerous state regulations. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Adam Yahya Reyes reports teachers gathered outside the House chamber in opposition to that measure this week, saying it will silence them.
Under this bill, school administrators would no longer have to discuss class sizes, safety, and other working conditions with teachers' elected labor representatives. Association of Public School Superintendents Director Robert Taylor argues discussion will not die with the mandate.
Now, I don't believe communication at the administrative level for a superintendent of public schools is an option. I believe it will have to and will continue.
But opponents like Democratic Representative Tanya Pfaff, a former teacher, say trusting all school administrators to have these discussions is naive.
We heard in committee that it would be shocking if administrators didn't meet with their teachers, and that we should fire any administrator that didn't meet with their teachers. If that's the case, why are we putting the option into law that specifically allows an administrator to do the wrong thing?
Without required discussion, Pfaff and others say, some administrators would ignore teachers' voices, harming students in the process.
John Schwanis, the question I originally wrote for you on this one was, should we believe that these discussions will still happen? But I'm going to rephrase it slightly, which is, why should we believe that these discussions will still happen?
Habit? Don't know. I don't mean to be flippant. This isn't about this bill this year. This is just this ongoing, decades-old philosophical debate about, the unionization of teachers and their ability to bargain collectively for money and these other issues, class size and safety concerns. And it has to do more with your opinions about, organized labor than anything else. It's not about transparency, but... Will they happen? I guess in certain districts there could be some public pressure, but keep in mind, just because you
and
schedule...
And certain district superintendents will want to have
those
discussions.
Yeah, but just... make this obvious statement, that just because you schedule a meeting doesn't mean you listen to what is said.
No,
so you can have your cake and eat it, too.
The thing I think I've struggled with on this one, again, this is not a bill I've covered, but you watching this, I haven't seen the side in favor of this really clearly articulate why talking about these things, being required to talk about these things is such a problem.
The only thing they've said was that it would somehow help the teachers who aren't in a union. And I'm just not following the connection on that. I assume if you're not in a union, they don't have to discuss it with you. But I don't know how taking that away from the other teachers helps.
Makes it happen for the others.
Yeah.
So that's exactly right.
And also, if I'm talking about class sizes generally at my school with this, it's going to help the teachers who aren't in a union just as much as it's going to help the... You're not suddenly just taking all of the kids in the unionized classrooms and moving them to the non-unionized classrooms.
Not yet, but that is
I don't think that's happening.
It's an idea, though.
It's just another happening.
It's just another attempt by the Republican majorities to try to whittle away unions. That's all. I mean, they don't like them. They think that it gives workers a voice, which it does. It gives them the right to bargain collectively for things. They don't like that either. This has worked for 50 years. For 50 years, it hasn't been that big a burden.
But that's the whole point. So, if you zoom out, this whole bill has been focused on this piece. And I think the Superintendent's Association, Bob Taylor, they were, shocked because what the bill tries to do is remove all these redundant training requirements for teachers.
Yeah, that's fine.
And now the teachers are opposed to
it.
This got flagged and misinterpreted because it's if we don't have to talk about it, we shouldn't be required. Now I got a meeting where I'm talking to you about what color the sky is today, and we all knew what color it was. That was the point.
If the list had included not only class size, safety, those sorts of things, but also, say, human sexuality, I'd understand why people want to ban those discussions in the school. But,
we're not going to stop at high school. We're going to go all the way to adulthood.
Finally, a member of the public testifying in a Senate committee recently called Senator Travis Holdman, who is from Markle, Indiana, the Sparkle from Markle. Mike O'Brien, which everybody has really enjoyed. Mike O'Brien should...
Especially Travis Holdman.
Yeah, he's loved it. Should more lawmakers get nicknames like that?
The best one, that's a good one. The best one in the State House, though, is Bob Heaton's. Bob, of course, famously put Indiana State into the Final Four with the final game-winning shot in 1979 and was called the Miracle Man. He's also the House Whip. So they call him Miracle Whip.
Yeah, that's good.
That's pretty fantastic. I got to be honest, I was trying to think about another nickname, and None that I can say on the air for sure. So
I've got one for Jim Lucas, the gun bore from Seymour.
The gun bore from Seymour. It does rhyme and does seem to fit. Capture a certain he does love guns.
You know, my sense is Ann has a nickname for her favorite legislator, Ed Delaney, but I don't know if you're going to tell us what it is.
No.
Okay.
Nikki,
we'll wait
for
one.
Thank God.
Nikki, the hardest, I think we were, when this happened, a bunch of us were waiting on the House floor for lawmakers to come in, and we were just kind of going around, okay, there, you know, Tim West goes from Osceola. Nothing
you
rhymes
can't,
with
yeah,
Osceola.
You can't do that.
Yeah, that's the real problem, isn't it?
You need like a real simple one, although... Yeah, I came up with a few, but they're not appropriate.
Yeah, that's probably...
Neither is hers for Ed.
One rhymes with French lick. I'll just say that.
Oh. Yeah,
all right. Wow. Well, we're out of time.
Oh, I think I know what
that,
it is.
That is Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Indiana Capital Chronicle. You can find Indiana Week in Review's podcast and episodes at wfyi.org/IWIR or on the PBS video app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana's public broadcasting stations.